Okay. We want to finish up our discussion of the Mitzvah Saseh of Shemitah, as I said. We're going to hopefully move on to Tosefes in our next year, whenever our next year may be. Tonight, again, we have three items that we want to cover, like last time. Last time we only got to item one of the three items. Hopefully tonight we'll be more successful. The first was the question that we left off with last time, another application of the Minchas Chinuch of the questions that we've been discussing. Number two is the critical Ramban that appears in source number 9. And then number three, the Rambam Shita on this topic, which I hope, if we don't finish, we'll at least get started tonight. The question that I left you all with was the following. We've been discussing the Mitzvah Saseh of Shemitah. And the primary central conceptual question that we've been discussing, the Chakira we've been discussing, is as follows. Is it just a reiteration of the Mitzvah Lo Sa'aseh? In other words, Shemitah is really bad, as we saw in our very first shir. Galus is caused by Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayah, Shvichos Damim, and Shemitah. So it's really a critical Mitzvah. So the Torah gives you not only a Lo Sa'aseh, but also an Aseh, that if you work the land, you're violating both. Or is it, in a certain sense, conceptually distinct, and perhaps more all-encompassing, insofar as the Mitzvah Saseh dictates, that not only is it prohibited for you to work the land, that's the Los Assay, the Assay tells you, see to it that the land rests. Don't create a scenario or allow for a scenario in which the land is worked on Shemitah. And the primary nafkamina that we discussed one other nafkamina that we'll circle back to at a future point, but the primary nafkamina we've been discussing is Avoda Ayidei Nachri. Can I ask a non-Jew to work my land for me? Putting aside Amir Lanachri issues, or perhaps renting out my field to another Jew who's not going to properly observe Shemitah, a Chiloni farmer. So putting aside considerations of Amir Lanachri and Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol, have I violated the Mitzvah Saseh of Shemitah itself? And we saw that was a machlokas among the Rishonim and certainly among the Achronim. Some held that itself is a violation of the Mitzvah Saseh of Shemitah, because the Mitzvah Saseh dictates, see to it that the land rests. If I facilitate a scenario in which the land is not going to rest, it's going to be worked, then I have violated that Mitzvah Saseh. Now, the question that we were considering in source number 8 was as follows. Let's say, immediately before the Shemitah year, I put a seed into the ground. And I know, because of my 9th grade biology class, that clearly it's going to germinate and it's going to grow over the course of the Shemitah year. I'm putting it in right before Shemitah. So once again, you have the question of the Tosefes Shvius, right? You've already violated Tosefes. You have to add on to the Shemitah year, and you planted right before the Shemitah year. Fine, that we'll leave aside. That will be our next sugya. Have I violated the Mitzvahs Aseh of Shemitah by doing so? That was the question that I left you all off with. So you had a week to think about it, so yeah.
Question for you. So if I'm a farmer and I grow corn, right?
Your farmer grows corn, okay.
And I leave some plants just in the field.
Right.
I know that they're going to seed and they're going to fall into the ground and they're going to grow as new corn plants the next year.
So yeah.
Is that any different? I mean, it's...
So nobody would tell you that you can't plant six years out of this. Then you'd never be able to plant ever, right? And the Torah has no issue with allowing the land to produce produce naturally, right? It's specifically
right.
Working the land. So I think the question here would be, can we consider it, because it's so close to Shemitah, can we consider it a violation of the Mitzvah Saseh? Certainly, if you planted in, I don't know, again, most of, let's say, year 5 and year 6, right? And then let the land do its thing in year 7, that would not constitute a violation of the Mitzvah Saseh. But I hear your point. Maybe
but
that should just be a natural
that
extension.
Grow right up to the beginning of the year. I mean, so, you know, they're fall crops, right? So if you leave those, they potentially are going to germinate, right?
So let's, again, so... We'd have to draw a line somewhere, clearly, right? And that's what you're highlighting, and it's a fair point.
Right.
But let's say if you were working those crops the day before Shemitah, rather than just letting them grow. If you were letting them grow, that wouldn't be a problem. Our question is specifically, you're working them right before Shemitah.
You Shabbos, how do you plant? You know, same thing. If something breaks down, then there's a certain...
So we'll talk about that in a second. Yeah, Mati.
I think that you can make the distinction that in order to violate the law, you have to do some things that causes... someone to be working the land.
Great. Okay, fantastic. Okay, two excellent points. So I guess I'll circle back to Henry's... let me address Henry's point first, and then Mati, I'll circle back to yours. Henry points out that, you could have a parallel question by Shabbos with Melech HaZoreya. And indeed, it is a question, a major question in El Shabbos. One of the questions of Melech HaZoreya is, when do you violate Zoreya? It's a major discussion of the Eglei Tal and the Menchas Chinuch. Is it specifically when... The parallel question exists in Hilchos Shabbos, right? If I, with a nafkamina for, let's say, is there a toelas, is there any value or advantage for me pulling it out? Let's say I put a seed in the ground on Shabbos. But it's almost the opposite case of what we're dealing with. Let's say I put a seed in the ground on Shabbos, but I know it's only going to take root after Shabbos. Is there any advantage for me to dig it out on Shabbos in order to avoid a melacha d'oraisa? That's the discussion among the Achronim. And it's contingent upon whether you view the violation of Shabbos at the moment you put the seed into the ground, or does it wait for the moment that the roots grow and the seed germinates? Now, in addressing Mati's point, let's take a step back. So one can argue that maybe this should be contingent on the same chakira, the same logic that we've been discussing all along. If the mitzvah saseh of Shemitah just is another reiteration of don't work the land during the Shemitah year, then will you have violated it if you put a seed before the Shemitah year? Quite obviously not. It's just telling you don't work the land during the Shemitah year. If it's telling you see to it that the land rests, then perhaps one can make the case, and the Menchas Chinuch indeed considers the possibility in source number 8, that perhaps you will have violated the mitzvah aseh because you are creating a scenario where the land is working during the Shemitah year. Let's just take a look at source number 8. The Yesh Lachkor Inema De'ein Isur Zriya B'Tosef Eshvias Avshar Mutar Lizroa Min HaTorah Ad Rosh Hashanah. He says, let's say you have a scenario where there's no problem of Tosefes. Again, whatever that scenario may be, that's our next topic. Maybe it's Mutar to plant all the way until Rosh Hashanah. Av Shetishresh B'Shvias. Even if it's going to take root during the Shemitah year. He makes the parallel to Shabbos, Henry, right? Says that it should be mutter until the moment before Shabbos. Or in the bold, O Efshar, Kivan de Kvar, Kosavdin, de Mitsuba Manachnu, Ashvis as Karkaos, Bishmita, Viagandam Shabbos, Osir, Le Beishama, Misham Shvis as Kalem, Kimavor, Bishabbos, Tavyuches. Or he considers the possibility, maybe it's usher, because of the mitzvah aseh. Mitzvah aseh of Shemitah to ensure that your land rests. The Minchas Chinuch is considering the possibility, strongly considering the possibility, that perhaps this question is contingent on the same conceptual question as working al yedei nachri. Now, is it so clear that the lamda should be the same? And here, Mati offers a distinction. Now, before we get to Mati's distinction, let me try to make a broad conceptual point about how to properly assess this case. Whenever you're dealing with two cases that are compared to one another, conceptually, let's say in this case the Minchas Chinuch is comparing two different cases. One is Avoda Al Yedei Nachri, where you give the land to somebody else to work the land, and the other is a case where you put a seed in the ground right before Shemitah. We always have to ask ourselves, or the way I like to put it, is we have to ask ourselves two questions. What are the differences between the cases? One. And two, why do the differences make a difference? Or, in other words, why are the differences halachically significant? Mashal amad over dama. Let's say you have a fine Jew, Yankel, who decides to tie his shoes on Shabbos. So he knows that he's supposed to start with his left foot. He's a righty. So he ties a single knot on his left shoe, and he ties a double knot on his right shoe, okay? And then somebody comes over to him and says, on your right shoe, you potentially violated an Issur D'oraisa of kosher b'Shabbos. But on your left shoe, you didn't. So Yankel could come along, and he could try to figure out why it is that his left shoe is okay, and that his right shoe is not. So he could come to the erroneous conclusion that perhaps on Shabbos, you're allowed to tie your left shoe, you're just not allowed to tie your right shoe. Obviously, that would be the wrong conclusion. He's identified a difference between the cases, but a legally insignificant difference between the cases, a halachically insignificant difference between the cases. Or alternatively, he can come to the right conclusion that on Shabbos you require a kesher shel kayama, so there's a difference between tying a single knot and a double knot. And then he would come to the correct conclusion that, oh, there's a difference between those two types of knots on Shabbos. In other words, he first has to identify the differences between the cases, left versus right, single knot versus double knot, and then he has to determine which of those differences is halachically or legally significant. So if the Minchas Chinuch is arguing to us that this case, and I want to point out, before we get into our Minchas Chinuch, that is a critical, critical tool in Limud Shas in general. It's what the Balei HaTosfos are doing all the time. You won't find virtually a single daf in Shas where the Balei HaTosfos aren't doing that. What the Balei HaTosfos are constantly doing is saying, oh, this Gemara appears to be Soser, this Gemara. Oh, they're different because the cases are distinct in the following way. And if you read a Ramban or a Rashba or a Ritva, they're all doing the same thing. That it's just an essential and critical skill. When you're dealing with cases, you need to be able to distinguish between cases and determine why, halachically speaking, case A is distinct and different from case B. So if you look at these two cases, are there any differences? And Mati suggests that perhaps there is one that is quite significant. In the case where you are handing off your field to a non-Jew or to a Chiloni farmer, you are facilitating what? Not just germination in the field, you're facilitating
work.
Human labor. There's going to be a person who's actually working the field. And says Mati, that could be quite distinct from a scenario where a seed happens to be germinating in the ground, but that's not really any human being applying their physical labor, their manpower, to work the field. In other words, how far are we taking this personification of the field's labor, of the field working? It makes sense to say, oh, I set up somebody else working the field, that's going to be included in my imperative to ensure that the land rests. Are you going to go as far as to say that anything that happens within the earth is going to be my responsibility as well? This kind of goes back to Joel's reductio. In other words, something's going to be happening in the earth at all times. Do I have to make sure that do I have to put down insecticide to make sure there are no worms in the earth that are going there and like to make sure that there's no motion or anything whatsoever? Obviously not. So I could claim that, oh, maybe the mitzvah saseh only would prohibit me, even if you want to say there's a more expansive mitzvah saseh, that it creates an imperative for me to ensure that the land rests, that might prohibit me from giving the land to another human being for working the land. But it may be perfectly fine to put something in before the Shemitah year if it's just going to lead to natural processes that occur during the Shemitah year. In other words, it might prohibit me from facilitating human work of the field, but it won't prohibit me from facilitating natural processes. And I think that's quite a compelling distinction, whereby one can argue that the Menchas Kenos equation between the cases is not perhaps perfect. One can argue that they are indeed distinct. And the Menchas Chinuch himself says something not, he doesn't quite articulate it in those terms, but if you look in the end of source number 8, he says something similar to that. O Esher de Shvizas Karka de Asra Torah, Hainu Ha de Mefursh Bekra Kagon Zriya Uzmira, Ovrim Gamkein Al Shvizas Karka. He says maybe Shvizas Karka itself is limited to facilitating those activities that the Torah prohibited in the Losa essay, Zriya and the Zemira. We'll talk about whether or not anything else is included, and the full extent of Avos and Toldos and Harisha, that we'll get to in due time. And maybe it's only those things that are included in the imperative to ensure that the land rests. But maybe other things, like just having the seed take root, would not be included in the mitzvah essay. So the Menchas Kenuch is perhaps suggesting that even if the mitzvah saseh is more expansive, it would prohibit giving it to others, but it would not prohibit putting a seed in the ground on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Follow up on that. Someone had follow up on that.
No, I mean, mitzvahs are generally in two categories, either result-oriented or process-oriented.
Right.
Right. So makkah is a classic result-oriented.
Totsah-oriented mitzvah, correct, yes.
But having a makkah around a building doesn't inherently make the building better if, let's say, the building has no access for humans to get into, right? You don't have to build a makkah on the building if you can't get into the building.
Okay.
So it's still, the result has to be tied to some type of human behavior. So, like, when your animals are not working on Shabbos, it's not because they're experiencing the, Kedusha Shabbos.
Right.
It's how we are supposed to relate to Shabbos by our animals not working.
Correct.
So, If the result-oriented mitzvah doesn't have any connection to human behavior,
you're reiterating this point. You're reading the chiluk or the distinction.
Yeah, but then there is, it doesn't make sense, right? So the result-oriented mitzvah still is tied back.
Your point is well taken, and rather than me responding directly, let me hold off on my response for a moment, and I will circle back to that point, okay? But you're effectively reiterating the distinction it's a really strong chiluk between giving it to a human being versus just letting it play out naturally. Okay, I hear it. Now, let me ask you the following question before I respond. Is there any way one can create an opposite distinction between the two cases and argue that this case is actually worse than the case of handing it over to a Nachri or to a Chiloni farmer? So far, we've offered a distinction, and again, I think it's implicit in the Menchas Kenuch too, that this case is not as bad as the case where you hand it over to somebody else to work the land and you just allow the natural processes to take place.
So
can we potentially construct an opposite argument to say that this case is worse?
You could say that what you've done, you know there's going to be a result that occurs during Shemitah.
Okay.
As opposed to selling it to a non-Jew. Another Jew, they may not work the land. They may hold.
Okay, definite versus indefinite. Okay, fair enough. I would say there's something even stronger. But yeah, I hear your chiluk. I think that makes sense.
Putting a seed in the ground.
Okay.
which is, if that's not the definition of planting.
Okay, so what is precisely, in precise terms, what's the distinction?
Well, the distinction is you don't know what they're doing, but you're actually putting, that seed is actually going into the ground.
So are you saying the same thing as Joel, definite versus indefinite?
Yes, slightly different, I guess.
The Jew is doing something directly before. In the case of the Nachri, the Jew is not doing something directly.
Okay, what about the case of the Chiloni farmer that you're giving it to? Still a Jew.
It's the same situation.
Okay, yeah, good.
So you're the one that's performing the malacha.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Mati and Saul, I think you're saying. Yeah, Henry.
And it goes back to the issue of looking at the pasuk, and if it is just for the land and the person, then even if it's a grama, even if it's the one step removed from the process, is a much stronger case.
Yeah, so I think what many of you are suggesting, and I think Moshe, you were also kind of going this direction as well, is that the distinction is, in this scenario that the Mishkanot that we're dealing with right now, okay, it may be that the activity that is done before the Shemitah year, but who did that activity? Who did that activity? Who put the seed in the ground? It was you. You didn't outsource it to somebody else. You are the one who put the seed into the ground. And granted, the effect of that is only going to be felt a little bit later once the Shemitah year starts. But it's still a result of your direct action. So I think one could have created an opposite distinction, an opposite chiluk, and say, look, in that case, you're outsourcing to somebody else. Zamir l'nachri, lefne iver lo sitein michshol, all those categories that we have in halacha for when you do an activity by somebody else. But in this case, if you deem that germination to be halachically significant, it's something that you yourself caused. And in a certain sense, that could have been worse as well. So you have these two nafkaminas, these two scenarios that potentially hinge on the same distinction, but depending on which of those differences you highlight and which one you deem to be legally and halachically significant, the results of these cases can really play out in either direction. This latter case that we're discussing about putting a seed into the ground before Rosh Hashanah, in a certain sense, there's a compelling case to be made that it's more lenient, but there's a certain case to be made that it could be more strict as well. And that's where the human component comes in, even though it's totza-oriented. In other words, you're connecting it to the human maisa that was done immediately beforehand on Erev Shvias. Granted, it's not happening on Shemitah itself, but because there was that human activity that happened beforehand, and I think that's the distinguishing factor from Joel's case as well. In other words, you have somebody, i.e. you yourself, are still putting the seed into the ground immediately before the Shemitah year. And that's where the Maisa takes place.
But you're not doing anything that's also.
But you are. In other words, right, the Asay dictates you should not do that activity that facilitates growth during the Shemitah. Right? That would be the interpretation of the Mitzvah Asay. You might feel that the first chiluk is more compelling than the second, but I think there's room to offer each. There's room to offer each. Questions before we go further? Yeah.
But doesn't the Menachas kind of actually question what the Isser is, whether it's Zuriya or he calls Hashrasha?
Right.
Well, that's,
I think that's in line. That's again,
but
not.
If it's Zuriya, then the Isser came before Shemitah. What happens later? Hashrasha is not the Isser.
Yeah, what's the Maisa Avera here?
I think that's precisely his point. In other words, you might say that there's no problem with the Hashrasha at all. That's what he's considering. Right.
But where's the Maisa Avera?
The Maisa Avera would be putting it in the ground right before Shemitah. That would be included within the Isur, the Mitzvah Saseh.
When are you over that Mitzvah, over that Avera?
When are you, it's a delayed Chalos, once there's the Hashrasha, similar to the case that we have in Nochel Shabbos. And again, this is a major discussion in Nochel Shabbos. I put a seed into the ground on Shabbos. Have I violated Shabbos right away? Or does that Iser de Oraisa, it's certainly Iser de Rabbanon, does that Iser de Oraisa only kick in once it's taken root?
But you're doing it on Shabbos. You're not doing it before Shabbos.
Right, but there are some who say you still haven't violated it even though you do it before Shabbos. That, the Nafkamina would presumably work in the
Erev Shabbos. And then
presumably, again, the same question would presumably exist in the opposite direction if you put it in before Shabbos. Now, Shabbos might be a little bit different because of a famous Nimuka Yosef that Shechler is very fond of. That argues that on Shabbos in particular, perhaps because of Melechus Machshavas, you need a Maisa on Shabbos itself. Shabbos might be a little bit different. But yeah, it's a little bit of a funny scenario where you'd put it in before Shabbos.
I would think that there would be a difference with Shabbos. Even if it's just an assay, Shemitah, the fundamental thing is that the land should not be, that you shouldn't be working the land.
Right.
But it's on Shemitah issue. Okay, but Shabbos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't care if there's constructive labor on Shabbos, right?
I mean, I think he does. That's why
he only cares. No,
He cares if you or me does constructive land.
Right.
As a matter of fact, he doesn't want Kayim to do constructive.
Correct, correct.
He wants Kayim to do constructive
correct, land. Correct, 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 right.
So it really is a Maisa on Shabbos issue, not... It's, so in other words...
You're saying on Shabbos there's a higher emphasis on Maisa than there is on Shemitah.
That there's more need for a Maisa on Shabbos
right.
than there would be...
Yes, I think that is correct. I think that is correct. And again, it gets us a little far afield, but I think, again, this relates to a famous Nimuka Yosef on the question of Isho Mishum Chitzev. I don't want to get into this so much right now. It's just good to know. It's a famous, when people say the famous Nimuka Yosef, this is the Nimuka Yosef that they're talking about. You know when people throw out the famous X or Y? So there's the Nimuka Yosef is talking about the sugi of Isho Mishum Chitzev. It's the sugi in Bava Kama. When you light a fire, why are you obligated to pay damages? So one of the days in the Gemara is Isho Mishum Chitzev, that's as if you shot an arrow and you're held responsible for the entire time that the fire is lit. It's as if you are lighting the fire. So then Nimuka Yosef asks, how can we ever light licht on Erev Shabbos if it's going to be considered as if the entire time that the candle is lit, you're actively lighting the fire, you should be violating Shabbos. What is the Nimuka Yosef's answer? It's a little bit difficult to understand, but one of the classic interpretations of the Nimuka Yosef's answer is that on Shabbos in particular, you need a Maisa. You need a Maisa to do it. So the notion that perhaps on Shabbos in particular you need an active Maisa is, I think, well rooted in Halacha. But certainly in this case, I think the Menachas Chinuch's analysis is at least plausible that perhaps the Maisa on Erev Shemitah would Erev Shvius would still be a violation once the Hashrasha takes place. Now again, he himself considers the possibility that Hashrasha is not going to be a violation, and it seems like many of us are partial to that argument. And I hear that, but I think it's at least plausible, or at least conceivable, that once the Hashrasha takes place, that would constitute a violation of the Mitzvah Sasei. Okay, any other questions of the Menachas Chinuch before we move to the Ramban? Okay, let's move to the Ramban. And the Ramban here, this is a really classic source, which is why I want to see it inside together. I think it's a really, really important source that's primarily about Shabbos, okay? But interestingly, has a comparison to Shemitah at the very end. Now, when most people talk about this Ramban, they do not talk about the Shemitah connection. I confess to you openly that before I was learning Masechta Shviyas, it's a throwaway line that I did not... I've looked at this Ramban 100 times, and I had never really noticed the comparison to Shemitah. But it's there. And the Ramban here is talking about the Mitzvahs Aseh of Shabbos, not the Mitzvahs Aseh of Shemitah. What is the Mitzvahs Aseh of Shabbos? So, there are a number of psukim in the Torah that imply that Shabbos is not just a lo sa'aseh, not just lo sa'aseh kol melacha, not just don't do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, 1 through 39, but it has an aseh as well. And the Ramban, quite famously, elucidates this mitzvah sa'aseh in source number 9, which is the Ramban's Pirush on Vayikra Perek Chav Gimel, Pasuk Chav Dalet. Now, the Ramban's understanding of the mitzvah sa'aseh is not universal, and we will talk about, probably not tonight, we will talk about how the Rambam understands the Mitzvah Sasei of Shabbos. The Rambam's approach is a little bit more ambiguous than that of the Ramban, but the Ramban's has become a classic. You know, if you're listing, there are certain Ramban ala Torahs that have canonical status. You need to have, if you're a Ben Torah and a Ben Yeshiva, you need to have seen these Ramban's. They're really central to our, to Halacha and to Hashkafa in general. Rav Lichtenstein was once asked about, the formulation of the question was a classic, slightly immature formulation. It was one of these, like, if you were on a desert island, you could take one sefer, what sefer would it be? One of those kinds of questions. I think those questions are a little bit silly, but it did offer him an opportunity to reflect upon different svarim and their kind of stature in our Masora. And he made a comment, and it was a comment that I heard echoed by Rav Aaron Lapiansky, who quoted this story from Rav Lichtenstein approvingly. You know, he agreed with the sentiment. Rav Lichtenstein said that if the Mor Nevuchim were lost tomorrow, it would be a tragedy, but Klal Yisrael would survive. If we lost the Ramban ala Torah, catastrophe. That was just his one description. If we lost the Ramban ala Torah, catastrophe. It really has a certain, right after Pirush Rashi, of course Rashi is the ultimate Pirush ala Torah, but really right after Pirush Rashi, the Ramban is absolutely essential. And this is a classic Ramban. We had a classic Ramban in this past week's Parsha, the Ramban on the end of Parshas Bo, on why Yitzias Mitzrayim is so critical in our Avodas Hashem, why we have so many mitzvahs that remind us of Yitzias Mitzrayim. That's a critical Ramban. This one on Vayikra Perek Chav Gimel is like really right up there among very, very important Ramban ala Torahs that are important to know. Source number 9, Yelachem Shabbason. What does the Ramban say? Sheyeya yom shvisa lanuach ba. That the day of Shabbos should be a day of shvisa on which we rest. For Amru Rabbeinu Shabbason asehu. And Chazal tell us in the Gemara Shabbos Daf Chaf Dalid that Shabbason is a mitzvah asay. Hine ha'oza melacha b'yom tov over b'lav v'asay. V'hashov v'esbo mekayim asay. If you do melacha on Yom Tov, you violate a lav and an asay. And if you rest, you have fulfilled a mitzvah asay. V'al da'atam ha'mo'ados kulam hukshu zel azeh. Kilonemar Shabbason b'chag ha'matzos v'la ba'atzeres. And according to Chazal, they're all hukshu zel azeh. We have certain, one of the things that when you're studying the Moadim and Torah Shebichsav, certain features only appear by certain Yomim Tovim and not by others. The mitzvah of Simcha, for example, appears by Sukkot. In one instance, it appears by Shavuos. It doesn't appear by Pesach. So when are they hukshu zel azeh, when are they connected and when are they not, is what the Ramban is referencing right now. Let's skip down to the bold. Ainli ela dvarim shehen mishum melacha. Dvarim shehen, he quotes now a mechilta. And the Mechilta says as follows, Einli ela dvarim shehen mishum melacha. I only know that it's prohibited to do things that are considered melacha. Dvarim shehen mishum shvus minayin. If anything is prohibited because of a shvus, how do I know that's prohibited? Talmud lomar ushmartemas ayom hazeh lahavi dvarim shehen mishum shvus. The Torah says, ushmartemas ayom hazeh, that tells you that a shvus is prohibited. Now, in a vacuum, that statement would be totally nonsensical, because what is the definition of shvus on Shabbos?
Drabanan.
Shvus is something that is only asur midrabanan. So the Mechilta is saying, how do I have a pasuk that tells me that things that are asur midrabanan are asur midoraisa? I have a pasuk, shmartem, esa yom azeh, to tell you that things that are prohibited midrabanan are prohibited midoraisa. And the Ramban notes that that's a problem. Take a look at the beginning of the next paragraph. Avalonis bar lizeh. This doesn't seem to make sense to me. You want to tell me, you know what? Sometimes we have an asmachta. Sometimes we have Chazal tell us this is asur midrabanan, but there's a hint to this isur midrabanan in the pasuk. That's something we call asmachta. If you want to tell me this is asmachta, the language in the Mechilta doesn't really add up. Kishavus bilshonam ne'emar lo'olam al shel divrayhem. The word shavus always applies and is always used to refer to an isur midrabanan. Now, whenever do we find that Chazal say, oh, what's the source for this Isur Midrabanan in the Pasuk? We don't find that Lashon of Minayin in reference to a Din Dirabanan. This is the third line of the second paragraph of Source 9. When you have an Asmachta, the Torah will tell you this Pasuk refers to Pasuk X refers to Halacha Y. And later, the Mepharshim will tell you, you know what, that was really only Derech HaSmachta. It wasn't an actual De'oraisa. You never have an instance where the Torah says, this is Midrabanan, and here's the Pasuk that tells you that it's Aser. This is Dirabanan, and here's the Pasuk that proves that it's a problem. It should have said things that aren't malacha are prohibited because of Shabbason. Then you could have said it's an HaSmachta, but this whole notion of saying a Shvus is Aser because of a Pasuk, that doesn't make sense. So the Ramban says, here is what I think is actually happening here. Look at the second bolded line of source number 9. It appears to me that what this Medrash is telling us, Lomar, there is a mitzvah asay to ensure that the character of Shabbos is restful. To make sure that Shabbos is a day of rest, and says the Ramban, that goes beyond Malacha itself. You already start to hear the parallels of what we are talking about in the context of the Mitzvah Saseh of Shemitah. There is an imperative, a Mitzvah Saseh, to ensure, to protect the restful character of Shabbos, even if we're not talking about Malacha. The Ramban continues, Lo sheyidrach kol hayom limdod hatvuos v'lishkol haperos v'hamatanos ulamale achavi osyayun alfanos hakelim v'gam ha'avonim yibayis labayis v'makom l'makom. It says, not to do all these things, to measure all of your yield over the course of the week and to weigh the fruits. He says to carry heavy rocks from one house to another, let's say it's a Rosh Hashayachid to a Rosh Hashayachid, to engage in all of these laborious activities that aren't technically speaking prohibited by Malacha. This is a famous line. He says, theoretically speaking, if you have a city with closed walls, he says, if you have enough Talmidei Chachamim involved, you'll close the gates of the city, you'll come up with loopholes for any malacha that may be involved, and you'll have a regular market day on Shabbos. You'll just circumvent any of the Isurei Malacha. Great, wonderful, we'll turn Shabbos into another weekday by just narrowly avoiding any Isurei Malacha. Again, the Ramban is really, again, elaborating how important he feels this is. This is like quite poetic language here. He's creating an image for you about what Shabbos is going to look like. And the workers are going to be getting up early to work. And it's going to, for all intents and purposes, look like an ordinary weekday. And all this is going to be mutter on Yantav and even Shabbos because there's no malacha. Lekach amra Torah Shabbosam. Therefore, the Torah gives you a mitzvah asay. Sheye yom shvisa umenucha lo yom Torah. To make sure that this day is a day of shvisa, a day of rest, not a day of tircha. V'zeo pirish tov v'yafeh. The Ramban doesn't always give himself a pat on the back. But he says here, this is pshat. I'm telling you pshat in the Medrash right now, the Ramban says. And indeed it is a pirish tov v'yafeh. The Ramban says that the Isurim d'Rabbanan that we have on Shabbos are simply ways of formalizing the mitzvahs asay to ensure that the day is restful. When the Rabbanan come along and make an Isur d'Rabbanan on Shabbos, it's not just because, oh, X may lead to Y. Very often that is the motivation. But it's not just because of that. It's because that the Rabbanan were giving you ways to ensure they're following up on the protective imperative to ensure the restful character of Shabbos. And so those shvusim, those shvuyos, those isurim d'Rabbanan that you violate are in essence a violation of the mitzvah saseh as well because of this imperative to maintain the restful character of Shabbos. Now again, let me just make a couple of quick points. Let's just read the final paragraph. Sorry, before we read the final paragraph, I'll just note, this has halacha l'maisa ramifications in many instances. It's kind of hard to determine where this line should be drawn in terms of the mitzvah saseh of Shabbos. But it is a classic question. I'll give you an example that we all deal with. Shabbos clocks. I use Shabbos clocks on Shabbos, and I assume many others do as well. Rav Moshe Feinstein was against the usage of Shabbos clocks because he felt it's going to detract from the character of Shabbos. Now, it ends up being something that picked up against the wishes of Rav Moshe Feinstein, but Rav Moshe was against it. Nowadays, they have a Shabbos lamp. How many people have the Shabbos lamp? Again, I confess, I have one, where you turn the thing and it doesn't, turn off. Rav Sobolovsky doesn't like usage of the Shabbos lamp for the same reason. He feels that that is coming too close to a violation of Shabbos. Now, where do you draw that line? Other poskim are okay with it. I can tell you one area where virtually all poskim have drawn the line is the Shabbos switch. The Shabbos switch is this grumma-activated machine. So I don't know exactly the mechanics of it, whether the mechanics work or not to avoid the malacha. Everybody has said that's just too far. You're going to be turning on a light and off on Shabbos. Maybe it helps in a context of, certain medical technologies where you have to be doing it anyway. So it's just another thing that helps out. There we'll often say that we'll use technologies like that. But to create a scenario where you could be turning on and off lights on Shabbos like you do during the week, that would be too far. So it has halacha l'maaseh ramifications.
Does this carry over to Shabbos on?
Yeah, it would carry over to Yontif as well.
So why on Yom? Because whenever they talk about Tircha in the Gemara, it's always because it eats into Oneg, as opposed to just coming back and saying Shabbosom.
Because the
can you carry four or three in this?
Right.
It always comes out that it eats into your Oneg.
Right. I think the Ramban would probably tell you that's an articulation of the same point. That Hainu Ha. I think the Ramban would tell you Hainu Ha. That they're the same. In other words, the eating into the Oneg is a function of the Mitzvah Saseh. Yeah, I think. And then just to conclude, the Ramban draws a comparison at the very end to Shemitah 2. He says the malachos on Shabbos have a lav and an onesh kares. The mitzvah asay applies to these other things as well. On Yom Tov you have a lav. It's not kares for the lo asay. Fine. And then the bold. The Ramban says that the mitzvah asay includes harisha, That is significant, as we will see. He includes plowing, even though that's not one of the narrow malachos that the Torah prohibits in the Lo Sa'aseh. The Lo Yavod Osa Klal, and make sure there is no work of the land at all. So this classic Ramban that has this articulation of the importance of safeguarding the Shvisa of Shabbos has a parallel command regarding safeguarding the Shvisa of Shemitah as well, and perhaps exists in a similar category of, again, going above and beyond to ensure the restful character of the Shemitah year. Be'ez Hashem, in our next year, we will take a very close look at Shitas HaRambam on all of these issues.